Would you like to go ahead?
Well, okay, I have just two comments. My first is a criticism of the chairman. Not a criticism, but a comment about the chairman.
This chairman.
Because there are several working scientists, or in my case, retired scientists here. And as a scientist who loves metaphysics, or loves philosophy, and especially metaphysics, I worry a great deal that science is going to put metaphysics out of business as it continues to bite into things, because our introductory talk mentioned cosmology as part of metaphysics. Cosmology is a science. It doesn't leave any room anymore for metaphysics, for speculation, if I may. But I hope this is not true, because it's a wonderful thing to think about. My other comment has to do with electrons being positive. Electricity is a natural phenomenon that we've known about since time immemorial. If you rub your hair with some wool, you can get your hair to stand on end. That's the phenomenon, and that's what electricity is. It is not electrons and protons. It's this visible phenomenon of attraction and repulsion. And the concept, of course, as people have pointed out, that the question of negative or positive is a question of just language and definition. We could have the world does exist with positive electrons and negative protons, so that you can make anti-hydrogen. You can do whatever you like. We don't even know what an electron is. We don't know whether an electron is a particle or is a wave. So we have a lot of problems, and using that as an impossibility is something we should rule out.
Okay. Yeah, I accept what you... You mean, so if you're talking about antimatter, then you have to swap everything around.
Well, I'm saying that in the beginning, there was an equal amount of matter and antimatter.
Yeah,
for every electron, there was a positive electron.
Okay.
For some reason that we do not yet understand, that has changed.
Sounds to mean all other things being equal.
Okay.
In which case the proton is looking positive. So all other things being equal implies the electron.
A positron is a positive electron.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yes.
But there aren't many of them.
Quite a few,
actually. Okay. But it's true, isn't it, that an electron is usually defined as having sort of a spin of a half or something. It can go up, it can be up or down, and it has negative charge. That's the usual definition
that
of it.
That is the usual. But the word is a significant word is definition.
Okay. All right. Frank.
Yeah, I think, can I come back to you and Wallace and ask you, how does Leibniz know, or put it another way, what is he explaining to us? Is his philosophy an argument to best explanation? Is there a best explanation of us? How are we made wiser or more knowledgeable by his monadology?
He thinks that if you think hard enough, monads are what you will think your way back to, because they are unanalyzable. And they are, as I put it, where the metaphysical buck stops. They supervene on nothing, everything else supervenes on them. So you can't go any further backwards, and you're stuck with them. Therefore, he would say, these form the metaphysical building blocks of what is.
Yeah, but until he gets back to substances, does he have any explanation of mind versus matter, or the immaterial and the material?
Interestingly, he doesn't, or at least as far as I can see, he doesn't. All he'll say of the material is that it isn't really properly existent because it can be, because it's divisible. You remember how he said that thing about what is not one is not an entity either. Then he finds that what he's got left with is something that very much needs the material in order to be anything at all. And that comes very much later, in sort of 1714, just before he died.
I'm just saying David Wiggins would agree with what David has just said about there can't be anything which isn't a something. Something of some kind.
Yes, that's right, yes.
Mike, you have something to say.
Yeah, I know little about Leibniz other than what I know about him through physics, through his great argument with Newton on several fronts. But it strikes me that that argument actually may be relevant to this question, in that Leibniz was a relationist. For him, space and time didn't exist, and were merely aspects of relation between some things, between objects, but no matter what. It struck me from what you were saying that in a sense these monads are exactly that. That each monad is simply a possible viewpoint, a possible perspective in non-physical meaning of the word, possible way of seeing the universe, and that they are distinct because if they weren't distinct they would be identical, so they can't, they have to be distinct. And there are infinitely many of them for reasons given. But that does not surely interact in any way with material existence or non-existence of the world, because he's looking at it from a completely different perspective. Is that about right?
Yes, he's looking at it from a metaphysical perspective, because he'd say that was the only perspective he got left, having rejected material things as a basis, as a candidate for forming the bedrock of what is. I don't find that particularly satisfactory, equating, thinking because things are divisible, therefore they, it must be, they don't exist. I'm not going to bother with them.
But I think you are missing his point here, if I may, because my take on it is that he's simply driving his relationist view to its ultimate conclusion in the matter of mind, so to speak, and that is what really matters, rather than divisibility of matter. I could be wrong.
Yes. What he attracts him about mind, and it's mind-like entities, not minds, is their very indivisibility. It's the same feeling you get when you read the beginnings of the Tractatus, when Wittgenstein rejects the idea of reality depending on the truth of the statements into which you've analysed material things. But, and he does have a very sort of ambivalent response to material things, even before the principles of nature and grace. You find him saying, well, yes, they do exist in a sort of way. Here's an example, the letter to de Volder in 1704. I don't really eliminate body, but reduce it to what it is. For I show that corporeal mass, which is thought to have something over and above simple substances, is not a substance, but a phenomenon resulting from simple substances which alone have unity and absolute reality. So you can see that he's the process of seduction's beginning.
The Higgs boson, we're thinking of that. Without the Higgs boson, mass would not exist.
Oh, yes, it would.
Higgs field.
Higgs field, quite right, yeah. Sorry, a
metaphor.
Okay,
you were next.
Yeah, one's on the possible worlds, which I'm not quite sure I've understood. But I have to read this question.
Can you speak up again?
This question, I have to read it because it's so unforgettable. But the name Aristotle, take the name Aristotle, which we used to refer to the chap who lived about 2,500 years ago.
Yeah, and you are an expert and I am not. Yes.
Now, would it make sense to say that Aristotle... Would it make sense to say that Aristotle, which is the one I'm referring to right now, might have failed to grasp the metaphysics? Or is it implied in the name, as I use it, that he did everything that Aristotle did, so that there's no possible world in which Aristotle, which I'm referring to, did not grasp the metaphysics, let alone any possible world in which he was a paper? That's the question.
Yeah, that's a very good question indeed. I think if Aristotle was a Leibnizian, he would say that everything that Aristotle ever did was included in his predicate.
Yes,
the predicate,
yes.
Notion, his complete concept. But on the Kripkean view and the Wiggins view, and on the really the modern essentialist view, the answer would be no. And this raises a very complicated story about how you pick things out. Do you pick things out via their properties, or because if you do, you end up having to know too much about them ever to use language effectively? Or are there some kinds of entity in the world, like individual human beings, for example, for which you use a label? Now, the term Aristotle for Kripke is simply a label for that man. Now, of course, a lot of people say this is very unsatisfactory because you can't think of him without a description, and of course you can't. That's not what's being said. What's being said is whatever thoughts about Aristotle you have are not part of the meaning of the name Aristotle. Okay. So the word Aristotle doesn't mean anything. It's a label on the modern essentialist view. On David's view, no. And I don't know what Aristotle himself would have thought. So he could have not, he could have not written the metaphysics. You get problems with descriptive names like Homer, because people say that person might not have existed. You've just got an author. You've got an author of a work. And so you've got a descriptive name, and there you haven't got an individual. You've got whatever satisfies the description. Okay. The minute you say whatever satisfies the description, you lose a grip on individuals. So what Kripke and Wiggins are trying to say, you start with the individuals before your language gets off the ground and before any metaphysical speculation gets off the ground. Does that answer your question?
Yes, I think
that's what I thought,
really.
You mean that's where... Okay, does that confirm what
you're saying? Essential kind of thing. Not so much to Aristotle, but to Greek philosophers.
Wiggins uses some terminology that he takes from Aristotle. That's where I got the notion of a substantial kind. But in fact, he talks about a substance concept, if it applies. If something comes under the concept at any time in its existence, it comes under it at all times. But as I said, thought of concepts are even more confusing than possible worlds because people interpret them differently. Charles and Frazer and Fodor, and it's just a minefield. Don't talk about concepts, really. Yeah. Sorry, Charles.
But Aristotle would have possible worlds built into him as a world expressive entity because logical space will be built in to the notion of Aristotle just as much as anything else. All that won't be built into Aristotle is the logically impossible, like be and not be.
So Aristotle could write the metaphysics, could have written the metaphysics.
No, because Aristotle said that most didn't he, that there's nothing in our minds but what comes through experience, didn't he?
I was thinking more that written into the monad is all the possibilities, rather in the way that written into a Wittgensteinian object is all the possibilities. No, if not, don't let's go on.
No.
I shouldn't really be speaking anyway. Tom?
Right, no, my question follows on from the last one. I wanted to ask Eileen about this caterpillar example, which you did refer to, about essential kind. And did you say that when a caterpillar changes into a chrysalis, it becomes not a caterpillar but a different kind?
Yeah. Well, the idea would be that it doesn't become a member of a different substantial kind. Okay. It's whatever kind of butterfly or moth it is, dozens and thousands of species. I don't know how many.
It ceases to exist.
No, it doesn't. That's the whole point. It doesn't. It's a continuant. Because it's an organism which comes into existence as an egg. It then becomes a caterpillar. It then pupates. Then it becomes a butterfly. And then it lays a few eggs and then it dies. And that's part of its life cycle. Its life cycle constitutes its persistence conditions, because we're talking about natural kinds here. Okay. And these, the point is, these have to be discovered empirically. You say, could it be a caterpillar if you use it?
So the name caterpillars, unfortunately, because that's covering a lot more.
I deliberately put in a couple of items which have phase states, because people disagree really about the ontology.
Your voice is dropping as you're.
Sorry. I wanted to include items which have phases. Like, the obvious thing is substances that go from solid to gas to liquid. That's not in the right order, but sometimes it is. Anyway, the point is that you do not get substance change when you get the phase changes, because phase changes are part of the natural existence and persistence conditions of these kinds of things. Okay.
Yeah, so then...
So the caterpillar's not the same as Lot's wife.
If it's not changing, then... But we've still got the name, the caterpillar, which then becomes sort of inappropriate.
I understand what you're saying. You're saying, well, then the caterpillar can't be a substantial kind term.
Yeah, yeah.
You would have to have a term... The term which is the name for the particular species,
yeah.
Or you could even use Lepidoptera, which is the order or whatever.
Yeah, but you've got caterpillar down as an essential camion, so it shouldn't be on your list.
I had it down as an item. Have I said that?
Yes,
I'm actually.
It's an object.
It's an object.
I called it an object. Well, it is an object. It's an object,
right.
Or an entity,
yeah.
Or an individual.
That's the difference between morphology and genetics. Morphologically there is a change, genetically there is no change.
That's right. Mm.
Yep. Yeah. So it's an instance of a kind.
Well, this is how you talk about kind. I mean, the natural kind itself is a sort of abstract entity, and it has instances or instantiations in the concrete particulars. You know, that are the lumps of ice or the puddles of water or the caterpillars or the butterflies or whatever. Okay.
Could you say that something can be the same but not identical to what it was before?
Didn't hear that question,
sorry. When you're talking about a caterpillar, could you say that it's... not identical to what it was before, but it's the same, because it's...
That's an interesting question. You mean, are the caterpillar and the butterfly the same thing?
No, I mean, identity... When you talk about identity, you're talking about things like A is the same as B, necessarily B is the same as A. Okay.
I understand that.
Can't change.
Yes.
But something might change, but...
Yeah.
And but the not identical with how it was, but the same as how it was.
Yeah. You probably have in mind Leibniz's law, which is if I thought you were going to talk about Leibniz's law, I didn't have time to talk about it. If A equals B, that means they must be the very same object, and they must have all their properties in common, essential properties and contingent properties.
So cannot butter them.
Sorry?
They cannot butt in
the place. They cannot butt in. Well, I think of it as a metaphysical truth, but of course it's a logical truth too. Okay. Now, Wiggins' big idea, really, identity and how it is kind dependent. So, if you're talking about a lot depends on how you pick things out. You may want to say, is this the same caterpillar, is this the same organism in this particular phase? And there'll be a yes or no answer to that. Okay, is it the same caterpillar? Is that the one I saw eating my cabbages, 2 hours ago, or is it a different one? Okay, but if you're going to sustain Leibniz's law for organisms which change over time, then you've really got to have a kind of, you have to time index the properties, okay? Because it really doesn't make sense to say that the caterpillar is identical to the butterfly. It just sounds, it rings oddly to our ears. So you've got to say, I think, you have to use a more of an overarching concept word, like it's the same organism, it's the same member of the species, blah.
It's the same knowledge changing.
Yeah.
You could use the Latin name of the species.
I should have done that, but I didn't want to show off. I don't know. I mean, there are just so many. Okay.
Can I just say, I've got you down. We're getting rather short of time given the number of questions I've got, so if you could keep your questions concise, that would be good. And I realise that you must say what you must say, but if you could keep it concise, that would be good. No, I don't mean to shut you up at all.
I wanted to ask about possible worlds. It seems to me that it makes it more confusing because possible worlds don't have any limits to them. You can invent a possible world in which the laws of physics are different, in which your language is different. Anything is possible. It doesn't involve a contradiction. Now, in such cases, the idea that a label such as Aristotle retains its meaning, I think it's completely false. It's just that the idea of the label Aristotle pointing at something which is transcends all possible worlds doesn't make sense. Aristotle's name occurred at his birth. Without his birth, from his parents, he wouldn't have that name. And so the idea of the name having a meaning in possible worlds in which that birth and his heritage didn't occur is just meaningless.
I didn't talk about the meaning of the name. I know I don't do that. Oh, well, at least I try not to. you're trying to say are you trying to say that the term Aristotle would refer to nothing in possible worlds where he didn't exist?
I'm saying of saying that Aristotle, asking the question, was Aristotle, or could Aristotle have been a paperclip, is a meaningless question, because whatever constitutes a paperclip is not the sort of thing in which the label Aristotle would be attached, given the meaning it has in our world.
Well, it's nothing to do with me. It's not the right kind of thing for him to be. I would agree with you, but there are some people who disagree, like Lewis, for example. This is very quick. You've got to distinguish between different sorts of possibility. David Lewis puts metaphysical and logical possibility together. Okay, and you really have to separate them out, because what's logically possible may not be metaphysically possible. What's metaphysically possible possibly may not be physically possible, but this is arguable. Kip Fine is the man who separates out these types of possibility. And you really, the possible worlds are, just think of them as a tool. You start out with the kinds of necessity and possibility you're interested in, and you look at the objects and you evaluate that way. I'm sure we agree.
No.
You don't think we do? Well, we can discuss that. We can discuss later.
Anyone else want to say anything?
Not anything deep, no.
Not anything deep. Well, you might get a chance to say it later, Patrick.
So this one for Jean. I think you mentioned a quote from Murray, saying that history can falsify metaphysical assumptions about presence. I just wondered in what way he would comment that.
Well, first of all, it was my words, and I did try to differentiate between his words and my words, but I realized it got a bit back and forth at that point. So he may say that, he probably does say that, but I said it there, because I think there are metaphysical systems that have quietly just gone away, and I'm not enough of a scholar, but you know, some of the medieval scholastic stuff, what I call how many angels can dance on the head of a pin type stuff, I mean, it just sort of goes for the most part, and it just isn't supported by history, by what happens, and people forget about it. I would consign Berkeley and idealism to that bin. I don't know if everybody would agree with me. It just drifts off.
Quick question. So, question perhaps to Eileen. But when you talk about essentialism, which so often I hear people using in a derogatory way, but do you always mean by the word essentialism belief in the validity of the idea of essential kinds as discussed in your talk?
That's another very good question. I'm sure that the essentialism of, say, Kripke and Williams and other modern essentialists is different from Aristotle's type. I think it's sort of the Platonic Aristotelian sort. You guys out there put me right if I get this wrong. It's the idea that essences are fixed. Now, and change isn't possible. So it would make evolution impossible. Now that idea's gone out completely. You've got to, if you can't account for change, your essentialism is worth nothing. Okay. So modern essentialists would accept evolutionary theory, of course.
Even in America?
they don't understand any metaphysics or any science, do they? I've seen you talking about creationism, isn't it? It seems to me that if you're a creationist, you don't understand. You don't know much about science and you don't know much about metaphysics. Sorry?
It too will pass.
I'm sure it will.
For creationism.
Yes. It wasn't around when I was young. Everybody I ever met believed in evolution.
Yeah, it's a follow-up question now. Aristotle. Sorry, I didn't ask you another question. But how do you use a label without description? Did you say this is a label? Well, I don't understand how that label works.
I didn't say that. I said, you pick something out. You're going to have a cluster of descriptions in your mind you need descriptions to be able to disambiguate the entities you're picking out. No one's denying that. What they're denying is that they are necessary to the individual that they're designating, because then you're locked into a definition of the object that you can't change. You can't account for change. I mean, if you think about water, think Aristotle thought of water as an element. Now, if you go with a descriptive view, that descriptions give necessary and sufficient conditions for correct application of the term, which they sometimes do in science, but you've got very carefully circumscribed definitions there, and whether, but anyway. You have to be very careful with natural kind terms, because these are things that we all know about. Aristotle knew about them, we know about them. You want to have Aristotle drinking the same substance that we drink. So you need a semantic that accounts for that. This is really Putnam rather than Kripke. But you don't want to say that we are talking about a completely different... You might want to do that. You don't, but most of us don't want to say that we're talking about a completely different substance from the one that Aristotle talked about. We want to say our knowledge is different and our thoughts may be different, but it's the same stuff. Okay, so water is a label, like Aristotle is a label. It allows you to adapt your knowledge. So you do have descriptions, but they're not necessary. Or if they are, you have to find that out.
So, picking out Aristotle, those descriptions are an excellent label to pick it out, but that description is not less so. It's about the description we can't pick it out.
I didn't hear that, sorry.
Well, yes, so the idea is you can pick, you have to use a description to pick out Aristotle. When the description we heard was it was the name given to him.
Yeah, but it's a contingent description.
But it's not a description that's necessary. So how does it work?
You can say Aristotle might not have written the metaphysics, so you think of Aristotle as the chap who wrote metaphysics, but I can say of him that he might not have written the metaphysics. If the description was a necessary then I couldn't say that, that would make no sense.
Yeah, but the conversation takes into account that it probably thinks that Aristotle was not. If I think that Aristotle is the person who wrote the metaphysics, nothing else. That's all I know about him. I would still stick with Aristotle wrote metaphysics, because that's my definition, that's my understanding of Aristotle. I actually think he might agree.
So you're
making
the
things.
Description. So you all think of the person who wrote metaphysics and you're calling him Aristotle.
Well, that's what you just told me, is my way of picking it
up. You can do things that way. You may not care who wrote the metaphysics. All you're interested in is the author of the metaphysics. So that's going to fit onto whichever object satisfies that description.
As
you're not starting out with an individual.
If I just go back to our start, it's not why the descriptions fail. It's how do you pick someone out without a description.
Yes, but you don't.
Or how do you label someone without a necessary?
You need a label.
You don't.
Because the description is a
you don't pick it out without a description. You pick it out with a description, but the description is a contingent. That the description names a contingent property of the thing you're picking out.
Sorry, what is a contingent?
If I say, right, David Kemp is the man who gave a talk on Leibniz at 2012 Members Day. Okay, there's a description that picks him up. So which person is David Kemp? That tells you who he is. Okay, it's a unique description, no one else satisfies it. It's fine, it'll pick out that guy. But it's not an essential part of David Hunt. David Kemp. Am I? Okay. it's just a useful disambiguator for making it clear what your subject of discourse is. That's the idea. You must have descriptions. Of course you must.
Could I try translating into what to me is more natural language, because I realize that philosophy is its own language. Are we talking here essentially about the fact that descriptions are context dependent, and Aristotle, for example, is context dependent on our knowledge of Aristotle. That allows to fix the label on him and ignore subsequent insufficiently large changes in context, i.e. there is a dynamic interplay between label and description. Neither is really sufficient on its own right.
I would say probably. That's all right. But as long as the description don't give you necessary and sufficient conditions for picking out a particular individual that you have in mind, because you're going to get into trouble.
But
they
do so in a given context. That's the key issue.
Because there may be other Aristotle.
Precisely.
We're assuming in all of this that when we talk about Aristotle,
you assume a
context.
Because there are thousands of other Aristotles.
Yes.
So we're always assuming a context.
Yeah. But exactly. I regard
but
that
the point
that's
is
true,
that
but a red herring.
Yes. I don't think it is, actually. Because that's the point of the question, as I understand it. Because the descriptions we use, your objection is that they would fix the object immutably. That is only true if the description is an absolute one. If it is contextual, it doesn't follow.
Well, that's fine. I'd be happy with that.
That's fine. Contingent.
Yeah, essentially.
Yeah, that's fine. That's fine. I mean, Kripke, who kicked all his ball game off, I mean, he was only arguing against such descriptions being necessary. So he's saying, not regarded as necessary, no problem. Of course we have to use descriptions. We couldn't survive without.
I'm really sorry, but we've still got four questions, and so I'd to let you have. You might have another question, but
I was just going to say, what you mean is there has to be a description, otherwise the label doesn't describe anything. So that doesn't label anything. You've got to have a description, but maybe you don't mean this particular description is the necessary one.
That's what you
I think we do. Yeah, you've got to make it clear what you're picking out, basically.
Mm-hmm. Gentleman here. No, not you, John. Sorry.
Sorry.
The gentleman behind you first.
Just a question for Jean, just to help me clarify something.
Can you speak right into the microphone, please?
You said that a lot of philosophy comes from Duncan's most philosophy. I'm just wondering, in the IDU camp, can you put linguistic philosophy and the philosophy of language in the action side and the IDU?
Well, that's interesting because Munroe says that the linguistic philosophers and the existentialists were two ways of beginning to break out of the I think, because linguistic philosophy always assumes a you because it's communication. Language assumes a you. So he would. He only felt, and also the existentialists, which I mentioned, but he felt about the linguistic ones that they were very, very narrow in their interest, and they didn't go very far, and they didn't go much beyond verbal communication in their conception. But so it was the first step.
Going back to Aristotle here, we discussed here about this unique label that Billy says is unique individual, Aristotle. But that surely is actually quite different from the list of particular instances you've given, in which, as far as I can see, only the first eight are actually universal, they're not particular individual things. The last kind of possibly big answer to that question, but I mean, surely there has to be some distinction made between something like the name of Aristotle, which does actually designate something absolutely particular, individual. As you said, there are lots of Aristotles that we know who may want to talk about that.
Okay.
So when we talk about a human being, a giraffe, a caterpillar, or any of these, they're not individuals, they're universal.
Okay, you're quite right, yes. Point taken. Did people understand that? I mean, they're basically general terms. Yes, thank you, yes. They're bad examples then. I should have made the language clearer. A particular giraffe, a particular block of ice. No, you're absolutely right. I agree with you. No, you're absolutely right there. I was working fast.
John.
Phil? No, I don't need the thing. I've got a loud voice.
Yeah. Oh, no, back.
I just want to challenge the outrageous statement by our excellent chairman right at the beginning of this session, who said that we don't want any more Leibniz because the excellent physics, if it goes on at its present rate, will put metaphysics out of business. Now, I always thought that physics was to do with physical things which are extended. They occupy space. How much space does love or goodness occupy? Is it extended? Are they extended? Are they part of the physical world? Are they amenable to physical investigation?
I don't think I said that. I didn't say anything. I didn't say anything like that. So I don't know how to respond.
I thought you said it was going to put metaphysics out of business.
I think he said it's No. It was somebody else.
Closer to what I said.
Somebody else. Yes.
I'm sorry. I apologise.
Yeah.
Apology.
Sorry.
Yeah. He said that some physicists believe that. But that he denied that.
Which is, of course, complete nonsense, because a lot of physicists do a lot of metaphysics, they just don't call it that.
Exactly what I say. Yeah.
Well, actually, Leibniz himself gave an analogy for this, which is fairly clear. It's the quite famous mill analogy. Let's suppose you had a machine, a 16th or 17th century machine, like a mill, that produced perceptions. And then you go inside this mill, and you see all the cogwheels and axles and that kind of thing all revolving around. And then he says, but where's the perception? So there's always going to be a place for that physics can't fill.
There's no right to reply at this point. One more question, Frank, if it's quick.
Yeah, just quickly, if you have a mic,
speak up.
Mentioned almost en passant natural kinds and artifacts that came up. But did I take it that the cluster analysis really applies to natural kinds? For example, if you classify trees as elms and oaks and so on, that would be natural kinds classification. If you classify them as Polynesians might, as boat-building trees and roof-making trees and so on, that wouldn't be susceptible to the same kind of elements.
I would say the answer to that is yes, because it is the difference between... I shouldn't use such language in courses. I nearly said between what thing is and... Now, once you get into the area of intentions, of mind-like things, in inverted commas, it's a game-changer. You simply cannot apply the same rules. And that's one of the things that philosophy, psychology, neuroscience, they all struggle with, how to derive A from B. We all believe, most of us believe, that somehow minds arise out of matter. We have no idea how. Some of us have some ideas how it might be. But once you do have the ability of self-reflection, and consequently conscious reflection of the world, so many other possibilities open up that they're simply not innumerable anymore, and therefore cost analysis just fails, essentially. Right. That was my point about artifacts, that objects are really classified, artifacts really are classified by their intended use, if anything, and classification there of cluster kinds doesn't work.
I agree with that.
Yeah, I know you do.
Well, that's a good place to stop. Okay, my heart swells with pride when I hear these people doing things like this. Quite a few of you I taught right at the beginning, didn't I, with the philosophy certificate. You and me did the philosophy certificate course right from the beginning, 100 years ago. Anyway, my philosophical heart swells with pride. I think they're absolutely wonderful. I think you all gave fantastic talks. You agree?
Yes.